Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Barry William Magnetti, your host of the Comeback Game podcast and this episode of the Freedom Series. Today, I'm joined by Jordan Harbinger, who's the host of the Jordan Harbinger podcast. Mate, how are you doing today?
Good, man. I'm just working through your last name bit by bit here on a Wednesday. Is it a Wednesday? Yeah.
Yeah.
I looked at your name and I was like, meh, okay, just going to stick with Barry.
Yeah. You want to give it a shot?
Magliarditi?
Yeah, nailed it.
Yeah, okay.
Same. Nailed it.
All right, still got it.
Yeah, still got it. Mate, pretty stoked to have you on board. Like, you've done some amazing things in your time. So you started off, obviously, studying to be a corporate lawyer, became a corporate lawyer on Wall Street. Noticed that there was this one guy within the office that was never kind of there, yet managed to keep his job. And I guess intrigued you to understand how was he able to go out and schmooze all these people, still have a job. And that led you on the path to, I guess, where you are now, the podcast. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I worked as a Wall Street lawyer for a while, and I was convinced that I was going to get fired because I was like, oh, they shouldn't have hired me. You know, I'm the guy who doesn't belong here. Everyone's smarter than me. Everyone, you know, just classic imposter syndrome. Everyone's really working hard. They all get it. I don't get it. And in middle school, I was the guy who was like, oh, I have a geometry test today. Shoot, I forgot. All right. Somebody show me the homework from yesterday. Do you have the homework? Oh, cool. Oh, I can figure this out. Okay, cool. I'll be fine on the test. Get a B+, whatever. And then in college, it was like, oh, everyone's smart. Oh, but everyone's drinking for like Monday through Saturday, whatever. I'm just going to like go to class. That's the bar. If I go to class, I'll be well ahead of most of these folks. So I did that and I was able to outwork everyone. But then I got to Wall Street and it was like, this was a group of people that went to class, were really smart and had all the natural kind of talent. And I was like, oh man, my competitive advantages are gone. And I thought my strategy was if I can be in the office as little as possible, then it will take them longer to find out that they shouldn't have hired me because they'll have less exposure to my stupidity or whatever. And therefore I might actually have a fighting chance at figuring out that I belong that I'm figuring out how to survive in a law firm, I guess you would say. Yeah. And so I went up to this partner who was never in the office and he was supposed to be like my mentor, but he was never there. Everybody else was getting mentored, right? In like this cheesy sense of the word where the HR, human resources is like, did you mentor this summer? And they're like, yeah, whatever. I took the kid to like Blue Man Group and like ate a steak with him once. So yeah, I did mentoring. My mentor was like, I got to mentor this guy. He wasn't a bad guy, but you know, he's like, let's go to Starbucks. He's like answering emails on his BlackBerry. And he's like, okay, you want coffee? I'm like, I'm good. It's 7 p.m. And he's like, okay, well, ask me anything you want. I'm like, all right. How come you're never in the office, but you're a partner? Do you just like work from home? Thinking that he's going to tell me the cheat code to working from home. And he's like, no, why? Why do you ask? And I was like, just because you're never in the office. I just figured like maybe you're working from home. And he's like, no, I'm bringing in all the business and all the deals you're working on. Like, those are my deals. And I'm like, so what do you do all day? And he's like, I go to jujitsu. I go golfing. I go cycling. I go running. I go to charity events. I go to play racquetball, squash, whatever. And I was like, how does that work? How do you make money doing that? Like, what are you talking about? Why would that be a thing that we need in the law firm? And he's like, how do you think people find us? And I was like, I don't know, the yellow pages, right? Like, I don't know. I don't understand how this works. And he's like, no, man, I'm hanging out with people that would be our clients. And then they're like, oh, Dave's cool. So they give me the deal and then I give it to you guys and we make money. That's how the firm works. And I was like, oh my God, I need to learn how to do that. I need to learn how to do that. I don't need to like work from home and just be underexposed. Like, I need to figure out how to generate business because Dave's like 40 and makes like $1 million a year or whatever. I don't know, $500,000 a year. All the other partners, they work 7 days a week and they're like 55. You know, what does this guy know that I don't? I mean, he was from Brooklyn and he had a tan. So obviously he had some tricks up his sleeve. And I was like, all right, I got to figure this out. So I go, all right, Dave, how do you generate business? How are you doing this? I want like the step-by-step. And he goes, well, you know, I went to Brooklyn prep, whatever, some sort of private school in Brooklyn. And he's like, a lot of my friends that I grew up with, they joined the investment banks. So they're throwing me the deals. And I was like, okay, so you just ask your friends for business. And he's like, pretty much. And I was like, well, I'm screwed now. because I grew up in Michigan and I don't have friends that work in, I have five people I know that work in investment banks at the same junior level as me at this law firm. So like, what the hell? And he's like, man, you'll be fine. Just be cool. And I was like, let me stop you right there. If I could just be cool, I probably would not have gone to law school. And I probably wouldn't be sitting here in the basement Starbucks of a Manhattan skyscraper being like, how do I not get fired? Right. Yeah. If I could just be cool. So I was like, this is not actionable advice for me, but I'm not giving up on this because this is like my only kind of real chance to make a partner at a law firm any time in the next century. So I went and started to learn networking and relationship development, but it was all like these Dale Carnegie sort of self-help life coachy classes where like some guy in a sweater vest who's at the YMCA or the Learning Annex is like, here's how you remember people's names. And here's the memory palace technique. And here's like how you look people in the eye and have a firm handshake. And I was like, I am out of here because not that everything was useless, but if I'm not getting $1 million law deal, gig, whatever sort of deal flow from Goldman Sachs, it's probably not like, well, we would love to give it to Harbinger, but he just didn't have a firm handshake and didn't really look me in the eye. It's like, no. The other guy spent 15 hours doing some thing with them or like plays jujitsu with this dude every Thursday, like for the last 5 years. It's not going to be my freaking handshake. It's not going to be because I remember that Tom's kids played tennis, you know, it's just not real. Yeah. So I was like, this is 101 kind of bull crap. Like this isn't the real deal. This is like what introverted people who can't do anything social think that networking is. It's like, here's my Vistaprint business card. Call me when you need financial management or a used car. I'm like, this is not high level. This isn't what the real deal is. So I started to study what I thought would lead me to the real deal. I was like, body language, nonverbal communication, persuasion. What are the elements of charisma? Like when you look at somebody and you're like, that guy is awesome. What is he or she doing that's different than other people? It's sure as hell is not like, wow, he had a really firm handshake. It's like everyone wants to be around them. Everyone likes them. Everyone will give that person business because they think they're really cool and friendly and trustworthy and likable and all these other positive adjectives. And I was like, I need to work on that stuff. And if I work on that stuff now, then in 5 years, when all of the people who are starting this law firm with me find out that you also have to generate business for the firm, they'll go, I can't do that. I'm just going to keep my head down and work. And I will then have an advantage because it will be too late for them to catch up. It'll just be too late. They'll be like, start networking now. I've been working in a basement on, you know, legal briefs for 5 years. What do you mean? And I'll be like, I saw this coming. I now have the advantage. You know, it's like, I have the data and the experience, and they wouldn't. So I just got to work doing that. And that was kind of how I got started.
Yeah. Where was the drive from initially to become a lawyer?
It was just the default thing that I would say this in America anyway, if you're an overachiever, but you don't know what you're going to do with your life, you go to law school because everyone's like, you should be a lawyer. And it's like, usually like somebody, like, it's like my aunt who's a gym teacher. She's like, you should be a lawyer. And I'm like, based on what? You know, but you don't think about that as a kid. You're like, oh, an adult said I should be a lawyer. And then, you know, now I ask them those questions now because they're like, wow, it's funny how you're like this entrepreneur and you're doing all this and this and this. And I'm like, yeah, why did you tell me I should be a lawyer? And they're like, I never said that. Or they're like, oh, because, you know, you like to argue. And I'm like, that's the dumbest freaking stupid ass reason to become a lawyer ever. First of all, lawyers don't even argue 99.9% of the time. And that's if they even go to court to argue. Yeah. And when you're arguing a case, you're not sitting there being like, I want this, you know, like that's not how it works at all. So they've seen like, you know, again, like your aunt, who's a gym teacher, saw like a couple episodes of Law and Order. And she's like, you should do that. It means nothing. Like never listen to those people. And about this anyway. So it just was like this sort of path where it was like, huh, I can either get a job at Best Buy selling CDs, Britney Spears CDs or something like that for like 3 years, working with 17-year-olds, even though I'm 24 and have a degree from the University of Michigan that I have to pay off. And it's like 60 grand, or I can just get more education and then I'll maybe get a better job. And for me, I got a great job. I got paid like $170,000 or 180 grand a year first year out of school. And I think the average household income for two people in the United States was like $50,000 the year I graduated or something. So this was like awesome. I mean, you were just absolutely killing it. You were in the top 1%. for your age bracket, and you were kind of guaranteed to be in that top 1% for the rest of your life, unless you screwed something up. So I was like, this is where you go. It's like a safe play. Nobody who goes, I bet you like 10% of the people in law schools actually want to be lawyers. It's probably not even that high. And at the top tier of schools, it's even less, because everyone's like, I just want to make money. Yeah. They don't even care. It's like you go to the law school and you're like, ah, I guess I'll go to an investment bank because they get paid 400 grand a year. You have no life, you know, or it's like, oh, I'll go to a big law firm, get paid 200 grand a year. And then, you know, start from there. That's really kind of what it is. Very few people who go there are like, I want to do something with law because it's important, because you can go to a cheaper law school and do that exact same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Just for a moment, if you're watching this live on the various platforms, welcome. So grateful to have you on the show. I've got Jordan Harbinger here, who's the host of the Jordan Harbinger Show. Gets over 6 million downloads every month. I want to get to that in a second. If you are watching, hit the like button. Let us know that you are there. And please post your questions and comments through. And Rafi from my team will make sure we get them answered today for you. So I'm curious to dig into this imposter syndrome a little bit. Like, it's something that we experience a lot with entrepreneurs. I had a previous guest, Alex Schaff, on the show, who talks a lot about this as well. What had you feeling that you're an imposter? Like, obviously you did enough work to get a job in the law firm in the first place, but what was it that had you sitting there thinking that you needed to be something other than what you actually were to earn a spot at the table?
Well, it's not really that. I mean, it probably is exactly that, now that you mention it. But like, looking at it now, it's something that all high achievers have, except for those that lie about it. I guess there's a few of those. And then there's also people that are extremely narcissistic and entitled that don't have it. And then there's other people that go, wait, I don't have that. But usually when I give a talk at Apple, everyone's like, I have that. Right. And then if I give a talk at the Naval Academy, everyone's like, I have that. When you give a talk at a high school, everyone's like, I don't have that. And I'm like, that's because you're in high school and everyone here thinks they know everything. And nobody's really in a high performance environment. You're in a public high school. Yeah. Right. Like, maybe if I gave a talk at like a really competitive private or Bay Area high school, people would be like, oh man, I'm screwed. But you're in a public school. They're not going to kick you out because you didn't get straight A's. You might feel pressure, but you don't feel imposter syndrome. So yeah. Chances are, if you don't feel imposter syndrome and you're not like a narcissistic prick, you probably are not really being challenged that much, or at least the people around you, I would say, are not really performing at a super high level. Because I don't know anybody, like, I'll talk to a Navy SEAL and they have this. I talk to special forces and intelligence operators, they have this. It comes from being in an environment that requires high performance, because you're naturally going to compare yourself to those around you. And yeah. You're going to go, oh my God, you know, you're using your blooper reel and you're comparing it to other people's highlight reel. So you're not going, oh, I'm so good at this and I'm so good at that. You're going, this person's smarter than me. This person's more charismatic than me. This person, they work really long hours. And this guy is the nephew of one of the partners. Like, they're good to go. I don't have any of those advantages. And then of course, everyone else is going, Jordan speaks 5 languages. He's really going to be favored for this project. Ah, man, he's a fast talker. They're going to love that. Oh, he's got a good sense of humor. They love that. Everyone loves Jordan. I'm going to get fired. So everyone kind of had that same thing. Some people have it worse than others, but I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to get fired. This is really horrible. And then telling a group of friends at the law firm that I had that, and what a couple of them would go, ah, you're fine, man. I mean, I think everyone thinks that way. And I was like, oh, they're just being nice to me. And then I remember observing over the period of like the next couple of years that I worked at the law firm, and there'd be guys that would like walk into my office and go, I know today's the day I'm getting fired. I know that today's the day I'm getting fired, because Tom, he called Keith into his office. And then like, Keith, you just left, man. I think they're firing everyone. And I'd be like, calm down, man. And I realized, oh, he also has that's the same thing. It's the exact same thing. He's got it. He just doesn't know what it's called, because none of us knew what it was called back then. We just all have our sort of neurosis about this. And entrepreneurs have it just as much as anyone else. Maybe you talk about it more, but I think entrepreneurs are always doing this. Even if you work for yourself, you're like comparing your business with somebody else's business. There are maybe lesser or lower, more collaborative and less competitive environments, but I think most people, even in a collaborative environment, are going, oh man, I'm the dead weight on this team. You know, Tim, he's a genius and he's got 10 years of experience, and she is so smart and knows all these people in the industry, and I'm the new guy. And then all the other new guys are like, I'm the new guy that's not funny. I'm the new guy that's not interesting. I'm the new guy that's not experienced in all these other areas adjacent to what we're doing. So I think it's extremely common among any high performer. I challenge you to find me a high performer that doesn't have some form of imposter syndrome where they're worried they're going to be found out as a fraud and that is like impervious to criticism. You know, I just don't know one. Maybe like a couple of billionaires like Mark Cuban is like, I don't have that. I guarantee you he used to and or still does, but just buries it, you know?
Yeah. It's an interesting point you make, like you shared about, and it's so true, especially with social media, is that so often we're comparing behind the scenes footage with someone else's highlight reel. Right. And there's that constant comparison. I know for myself, I went through this period of time where it was really noticeable. It was like the more successful I became, the more of a fraud I felt. And yeah, I was like,
that's exactly what it is.
Like I've achieved so much more now than I had 10 years ago. Yet I feel even more like an imposter now than back then. I guess, you know, you've been fortunate enough to speak to some pretty amazing guests through your podcast as well. I'm curious to know, like, have you used the same strategies you used back at Bring Business Into the Law Firm to attract those high profile guests?
Yeah, I mean, it's straight up networking. There's really no difference between getting someone to know, like, trust you in a sales role than there is in, yeah, it's essentially, it's just a sales role, no matter what. Like, getting someone to come on the show, sales. Creating and maintaining relationships over a period of time, getting people to know, like, trust you. That's all it is. So anybody who, there's a lot of amateurs in the sales area. They're like, you have to be convincing and you have to be able to like handle this objection. Here's this cool phrase you can use. And I'm like, that's smooth talking. That's like the green belt level of sales. White belt is like, please buy this. And people are like, no. And you're like, what do I do now? Right. Green belt is like, please buy this. And then the green belt's like, oh, well, you know, actually this, that, and the other thing, here's the benefit of this. Oh, you have an objection? Let me handle that right now with this ninja move that I learned the other day. And then once you get to like the so-called black belt level, people, or brown belt would be objection handling before the objection comes up, probably, where it's like, I know he's going to say it's expensive. So I'm going to say, can you afford not to buy this? Here's all these different reasons. Whereas green belt just says, you can't afford it. You can't not afford it. Like one of those things. Black belt level would be like somebody you're not even thinking about objections because you're like, of course he's going to buy it. He's my friend. And I've been warming this sale up for like 18 months. Now they're at their point in the sales cycle where they need a new set of speakers. So they're of course going to cut. Like if they don't come to me, I'm going to be surprised and offended. And I'm going to be like bewildered that they're not buying from me. Why would they not? I cycle with him all the time. We talk about this all the time. Why would this not happen? And usually you're right. You know, like, why would they not give me this law deal? I've been close to this person for years. I've helped them out with countless things. I'm reachable 24/7 as a friend. So of course they're going to trust me to get it done. They're not going to get ripped off. Like this is a done deal. It is a foregone conclusion. It's very similar with guests. It's like, hey, I've been talking to this person for 8 months. Their book is finally ready to come out. The publicist might give me some baloney about like, oh, well, I'll see what the team thinks. And I'm like, I'm going to text him. Don't try and front like you're going to be gatekeep me. Like, get out of here. You know, like I already have this relationship in the bag. I don't have to go through the front door. I don't have to go through the gatekeeper. I don't have to go through the normal channels. Like this is happening. And that happens all the time. You know, it's like people go, how did you get Kobe? I'm like, his assistant was like, hey, do you want to interview Kobe? I didn't pitch, you know, the same way that everybody else did and had some publicist evaluate it in a conference room. That's a waste of time. That's not how real things get done. That's like the suckers play, right? Not that everybody who pitches a publicist is a sucker. Of course, I pitch publicists too, but generally that's the suckers play. Like that's not really how most people get what they want. The publicist is usually there in the case of the guest. They're usually there to keep people out. Just like the sales cycle for a large enterprise level thing. They have like a sales cycle that they've got to do. Oh, we've got to talk about it in a meeting. They're going through the motions. They've already probably decided. Unless my quote comes in three times higher, they're already going, we're going to go with Jordan, but we kind of have this thing where we have a meeting and then we put everything on the projector and blah, blah, blah. But don't worry, man. Like that's how that works. Yeah. That's how that usually works for B2B stuff, right? And it's the same thing for B2C. People will make up their mind about what they want. And then they're like, well, I'm evaluating my options. And I'm like, cool, go ahead. But obviously come to me with the best option that you have. And then I will figure out how to beat that because I've already got the sale in the bag. And of course, you know, your friends are like, okay, so-and-so is offering us A, B, and C. The price is this. And I go, cool, I'll match that. Not beat it. I'll match that. And they go, great. Well, I like you. So if you can match that, we're good. Or come close to it, then we're good. And if it's the company's money, they're like, can you get like close to it so I don't get in trouble? And I'm like, yeah, I'll come within 10%, but I'm not going to beat it or match it. And they're like, yeah, that's cool. Whatever. Oh, we want Jordan because he's a trustworthy, loyal vendor of ours. Okay, whatever. It's within 10%. All right. Stamp done. Checks out.
Yeah. This is where I think there's a huge mistake with a lot of entrepreneurs that I meet is that they're too busy playing the short-term game. They're too busy trying to pitch the short-term play without building long-standing personalized relationships and well after the sale as well. Like the second mistake they make is that they make the sale and then there's no aftercare. There's no follow-up. There's no continuously building that relationship moving forward.
Yeah, a lot of it is like the you're dead to me school of selling where like as soon as the payment comes in, it's like, what happened to you? Where are you? Hello. And then it's like, well, I'm never working with this person again. And then it cheapens everything you did before, all that hard work you did to build a relationship. They're like, oh, this was just a bunch of crap to get me to send you them. Well, now I'm not just annoyed. I'm super pissed at you because now I feel used. Not just I got a raw deal, but I got straight up conned. And that's worse. Like it's worse to drop somebody afterwards than it is to just do a hot, quick sale. Like if I'm buying something and it doesn't, if I'm not buying some cheap thing and I make the 15-minute evaluation, I'm like, I'll take it. And then the sales guy's not available. I'm not surprised. So I'm not offended. If somebody works me for 6 months and then I buy it and I'm like, hey, we're having problems with this. And they ghost me. I'm like, you're a con artist. It's worse. So you have to be really careful. You have to dig the well before you get thirsty. But then as soon as you get what you want, you can't just bounce. Most people don't do that though. Like people who play the long game, it's so much work that as soon as they get what they want, they're not like, well, I'm done with this sucker. It's like, okay, I'm not letting this go. I want to sell to this person for the next 30 years. I just spent 18 months.
Yeah.
What's that?
Let's over deliver.
Yeah, let's over deliver. I just spent 18 months trying to get you to buy. I'm not going to drop you next week.
Yeah.
Like that's just straight foolish. Nobody, very few long game people are going to play that because you're already playing the long game in the beginning. Now it's on easy mode. Every time they have to renew their insurance or whatever you're selling, they're going to come straight to you. Why would you then, you know, now's the time where it's on easy mode. You don't unplug at that point. You know, that's foolish.
Yeah. Yes. Very, very, very good point. We've got a bunch of questions coming in here, which I want to get to in a second. If you are watching live, welcome. Please keep your questions coming through. I'm going to ask them in just a moment. Before I do, though, like, how did you build a podcast to 6 million downloads a month? Like that's a pretty mammoth feat in any level of play.
I mean, truth be told, like there's no magic sort of formula for it. I've been doing the Jordan Harbinger show in some iteration or incarnation for 14 years. I started in 2006, you know, putting out stuff regularly for 14 years will do that. Plus, you know, I study the craft of interviewing pretty rigorously. Like I'm always emulating and working on these skills. I'll take like an improv class, a voice class, you know, I've got thousands of hours of practice in easily. That's just on my own show, let alone doing other people's shows, being interviewed, talking, speaking, you know, that stuff adds up pretty damn quickly over time. And then on top of that, it's like, this is my thing. I don't have a podcast to like, and no offense to people that do, but I don't have a podcast to like do lead gen for my landscaping business. You know what I mean? Like I do a podcast and people go, oh, how do you monetize ads? And they're like, you're leaving money on the table. You should be selling a funnel, this and that. And I'm like, no, thanks. I'm good. Been there, done that, over it. I just want a large audience that will listen to an ad for a Mazda or Salesforce.com. And that's how I pay the bills. Yes, I'm leaving money on the table and I'm fine with that because I don't want to do live events where I teach people how to, you know, sell courses to people who want to learn how to sell courses to people who want to learn how to sell courses to people. No, thanks. I'm good on that. And, you know, I'm not telling people how to market food trucks. And again, I'm not throwing shade on anybody that does that. I just found what I want, like essentialism. If you've ever read that book, I found what I want. I found what I'm good at. I work on those skills. I don't worry about the FOMO that comes in. Like, that's why people go, why don't you use Instagram more? Because I don't want to. I don't want TikTok as a cesspool of what? I got to show up and dance now? Literally? No, thanks. I'm like, I'm good. I'm not going to buy a puppy to put in videos. Like, I am okay with not doing that. And so I see people jumping from trend to trend to trend. I bet on podcasting because I saw long-term potential, and it was a winner, and it continues to be a winner. Like, you tell me about it. People always go, oh, you're leaving money on the table. Tell me about the last guy's show who got acquired for $100 million because they had a great TikTok. I'll wait. Nobody. But you have Joe Rogan going on Spotify for 100 million or 150 or whatever it was, 100 to start. Show me a social media influencer that's doing anything even remotely close to that. I will wait. I don't have that kind of time. I won't wait.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't one.
Yeah. Yeah. So true. And again, though, back to your ethos. So, like, it's playing the long game. Like, you have a network of 6 million plus listeners that if you did eventually down the track change your mind or decide to go into some other field, you've got a loyal following that have been following you for a period of time. Like, there's a lot of equity within that list.
There is. And I had to start my business over a few years ago because I had a nasty split with some business partners. And it was like, I'm going to end up litigating this. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to start over. And I built the Jordan Harbinger show to, I think, 5X the size, 3 to 5X the size. It's hard to measure because the IAB and the difference in downloads is kind of like a black box. It's a minimum of 300% to 500% larger than my previous business in terms of profits. So, like, why? How did that happen? Well, everyone left the old business and came to the new one. And you see that to some extent with, like, people who are really big on YouTube, and then they go on Instagram and they're like, follow me, and they get an Instagram following overnight. I can bring people from one podcast to another really quickly. But the difference is I'm creating a show that's an hour long multiple times per week. To get people to spend multiple hours per week with you, man, I know people who can't get their kids to do that. Yeah. And I've got people do it's perfect strangers doing that. Like, that requires a high level of content creation that my team is good at. It requires a ton of effort, a ton of time. You can't fake it by being like having like 6-pack abs or a bubble butt or whatever. Like, you can't do that like you can on Instagram. You just can't. Those people are commodities. Yeah. They might have 1 million followers. And I'm like, cool. But I've seen the balance sheets because I used to live in Hollywood. A lot of my friends are agents. And like, yeah, I'm repping this girl. She's got 14 million followers. Oh, this fitness guy, he's got 8 million followers. I'm like, man, how much money do those people make? And they're like, 6 figures. I'm like, 6 figures? If you had 1 million followers anywhere else and you were making 6 figures, you better be making 6 figures a week, not like, or like a month, not freaking barely scraping by. Like, if you are making the same amount of money as your local police chief, but you have millions of people following you, you are doing something horribly wrong. But that's what social media is like, man. You know, I know a lot of YouTubers and stuff like that, and they're great at what they do, but I've got friends that have like 2 million subscribers and they're like, yeah, we made 200 grand last year. That's great. But holy moly, if you had that many people watching your television show, you'd be making $4 million a year, a season. Yeah. You know, it's just the profits on those things are just minimal. And it's not because it's a crap outlet. It's not because what they do is bad. It's because so many people can build a huge following so quickly on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, that it's not that valuable. It's just not.
Yeah. I love that. There's not necessarily the strategy or the attention to the long-term game and what the outcome is of doing that. And I think too, I certainly know from many people I've been associated with, is there's an ego of like, oh, I've got 1 million followers on Instagram. And it's like, cool, but what are you actually monetizing from that? How much are you actually making from that? And we've also seen too in recent time with the censorship going on, that you've got 1 million followers provided that you actually talk about what the media outlets want you to talk about.
Yeah. And then you got to pay. Oh, tomorrow you got to pay to reach all those people. Oops. Like, nobody. It's funny because you, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 40. So I remember when you would be, like, it was like, you have to have a Facebook page, get as many likes as you can. That was the original sort of like, you can be an influencer. You have to have a Facebook page because you couldn't have that many people following you on Facebook. And then like Twitter kind of came around and there were Twitter people who were popular on Twitter. We didn't call them influencers and we didn't even call people like influencers on YouTube, which was kind of new at that time, but you would build a page, And then YouTube went. And I remember PewDiePie, who's like the most popular YouTuber in the world. He complains about this. I heard it in a podcast because I don't watch PewDiePie on YouTube, but I heard it on a podcast and he goes, one day they just said, we're not going to show your video to all your subscribers. we're going to just put it in a, like a playlist and they can play it later. And he was like, wait, what? And then Facebook was like, we're not just going to show everything that you put on your page to everyone who likes your page. You have to pay. And people were like, I spent 4 years building this. What are you, what do you mean I have to pay? I paid to get the likes. And Facebook's like, yeah, that's a new business model. And it happened overnight and it ruined people's lives and businesses. And yeah. I know that sounds like hyperbole. I know people that spend hundreds of thousands of dollars getting likes, and now they got to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to reach those people. Podcasting, it's not like that. It's an open ecosystem, so it can't be made like that because there are multiple powerful sort of players in that space, and people subscribe and they automatically get your show. Now, it would take a lot of collusion from big tech. It's not impossible, but it would take a lot of collusion from big tech to go, we're not going to show this podcaster unless they pay. And even if that did happen at this point now, I could pay. And it would be good for me if that happened. I'm against it. Let me be perfectly clear, but I can afford to do it, which means I would survive and a lot of my competitors would not. So it's, but like, you have to be really freaking careful that you don't, what is it called? A walled garden? Like, you're building your, people go, oh, well, you're relying on Apple. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. I got Apple, Spotify, Overcast, Castbox. There's all kinds of players in the scene now. But if you're a, if you were a Facebook influencer, do those exist anymore? Not really. I mean, and if you were on Twitter and you had a bunch of people looking at your tweets, well, how many views do you get now? I know people that have 1.2 million followers on Twitter. Their last tweet, I checked earlier this week. I had a friend who has that. He had two likes, two. I mean, what? Wow, that's done. I know people, like I said, I know people with 4 million plus YouTube subscribers. They get 6,500 views on certain videos because they don't hit the algorithm right. Yeah. That's bad news, man. Speaking of censorship, like all they have to do is go tweak and your business is ruined.
Overnight. Yeah. I love the realness of the conversations being had just now. I've got a couple of questions here. They are a little bit left field. We're going to ask them anyway, Jordan. So the first question is from Jim from Sydney. He's like, question for Jordan. How does Jordan spot signs of burnout in himself or in his team? And how does he take action? Is that something you experienced at all or have experienced?
Yeah. You know, what's funny is I work so much harder now than I ever have. And burnout, I'm not saying it can't happen, and I'm definitely feeling like I need a vacation. Okay, I've got a 14-month-old. The air's been smoky in the Bay Area. I can't even like walk outside half the time. That makes me feel cooped up, a little bit burned out. But the thought of like sitting around and watching Netflix or something doesn't make me feel any better. I need to like go to Italy or something, right? Can't do it right now. But when I was in my previous business, I was like chronically burned out, man. And I remember going to a doctor and he's like, we need to do a gut panel and this and that. And he's like, man, your adrenals are terrible. Like, you have like straight up adrenal fatigue. And I'm like, man, what's going on? He's like, do you have a lot of stress? And I go, yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. And he's like, okay. And then I went to a therapist and she's like, tell me about your life situation. And I was like, well, I got these idiots that I work with that are terrible. And I'm working in this business that I kind of hate. And she's like, starting to become pretty clear why you are this way. Now that I own 100% of the business that I'm in, like I said, I had that split off. And now the Jordan Harbinger Show, I don't have any of those problems. So how do I spot it? I mean, it's really sort of nebulous because it's like, it's a feeling of not giving a crap, but feeling like you have to do something or the wheels are going to fall off. That's burnout. Like, you have to stay in the burning house because you're the only one throwing water on the walls to make sure that the whole thing doesn't come collapsing down. And everybody you work with is kind of like lighting matches and throwing them around, you know, like that will cause burnout. What do I look for in my employees though? Like them being late for things, half-assing things, but the same thing I look for in myself. Did I just mail in the interview? Like when we first started, I was like, oh man, it's 5:30 at night. Oh man, I'm a little tired. Yeah, let me rehydrate. Now I'm in the zone. Like, I'm enjoying this. But in the beginning, it took me a while to sort of warm up. If I feel that way for like three straight days, it's time to chill. Like, I got to go to the gym. I've got to like read a book that's not for work. I've got to get some ice cream with my kid and wife. Like, I got to do that stuff. Because and it's funny because I sense it, like, not real like chronic burnout, what Jim's probably talking about, but there'll be times where I have to work through the weekend and it's like, oh, no big deal. But then around Wednesday of the following week, I'm like, whoa, what time is it? 1:30 PM. What, why? And then the next day I'm like, can you cancel this? I'm not going to do a good job. And my wife's like, sure, you need to take some time off. that's a really good and obvious sign. Like my body will literally just be like, I'm shutting down. You can try to do whatever you want, buddy. That happening over and over and over, no matter how much you're kind of like resting, that's chronic burnout. And that's like, you need to like go talk to a therapist and have them rip open your life, because that's probably like, oh, you work in a business that you hate with people that you hate doing a thing you hate, you know, like you need to get somebody to shine a light on that. Cause that's what real burnout is, not just being tired.
Yeah. Yeah. Good question. Jim, and appreciate the answer, Jordan. And also check out the last episode I recorded with Jeff Moody. He just actually relaunched a book called The Doctor Is Burnt Out. Had him on the show. Fantastic expert when it comes to burnout. So definitely check in on that. Another question here. I'm listening to this portion. Was a while ago, we talked about you being a lawyer. And I recall that the Dave Randall episode about the parents deciding for their kids. Does Jordan believe in parents, adults, mentoring, helping young people dive into certain careers? What's your thoughts about parents influencing their kids to kind of move in that direction?
Parents? No. I mean, look, kind of goes to our earlier conversation about people telling me to be a lawyer, right? I think you can help your kid explore things. Like if your kid loves making stuff and loves taking stuff apart, maybe they should look at like what engineers do, because they might not even know what engineers do. And then, but they're like, oh, but I really want to help people. Oh, and I'm really interested in science. It's like, okay, well, you have a lot of interest. But kids don't know what biomedical or biotech engineers are. Adults don't know what biotech and biomedical engineers are. So you have to help them explore that stuff. And I look at it like when I was a kid, my parents were like, I don't know what you're going to do. My mom was a teacher. My dad was an auto worker. So they were like, I don't know. You go to school and like, you figure that crap out later. Like, what are you looking at us for? They weren't really like that. But I mean, I was like, I want to be a radio DJ and I want to build an FM radio transmitter so I can tell people the news in the neighborhood. And my parents were like, that's nice, whatever. They didn't think like, oh, we should explore that. Like he should look into doing that. And I remember telling my mom that I wanted to be, there's a famous journalist in the United States. His name's Dan Rather. I don't expect you to know who he is, but super famous. Like he's one of the most famous people in the United States. He's retired now, but he was at the time. Everyone in America knew who this guy was. And I was like, I want to do that. And my mom was like, you don't want to do that. That you have to go. Cause I remember seeing him like in Vietnam and Iraq or whatever with like boots on. And I was like, that is awesome. And my mom was like, no, it's dangerous. 99% of those people don't make any money. You're writing all the time. And I was like, eh, I guess I don't want to do that. Now I'm like, that would have been the perfect job for me. In many ways, it's what I do now. Like, I'm essentially like an independent journalist. I just have a weird focus, which is on interviewing. So like looking at that, I should have been encouraged to do that. I don't blame my parents or anything, but I absolutely should have been encouraged to do that. Now, I think what our questioner whose name now escapes me because I need to eat some food or something. But like now I think what he means or she means is probably like, if dad's an engineer, should you be like, engineering is so great, become a doctor. And I'm like, nah, I got too many friends that are like Indian and Asian who their mom is like, you have to become a doctor, lawyer, engineer, or all three or both or whatever. And I'm like, these are all sort of universally miserable folks because they went with familial pressure. And I know a lot of doctors that are like, I literally just did this so that my mom would stop bothering me. That's the only, I hate it. And they're like, and I'm like, great, cool. Sew me up when you're done. Don't forget. And they're like, you know, like, hey, really? Is now a good time to tell me how much you hate your job? I'm kind of like about to go under anesthesia, you know? So there's a lot of people that succumb to that pressure. So there's a difference between guiding your kid and exploring and encouraging them to explore their interests versus like pressuring them to do something. Cause you're like, there's a lot of money in the banana stand. You know, you got to run this business. You got to do this. You got to do that. Doctor, lawyer, engineer. Everyone wants their kid to be stable, but you can encourage a kid to explore interests and do something that is monetizable and stable with, it doesn't mean they're going to like become a professional underwater basket weaver. Like you don't have to pressure your kid to do something. You should encourage their interests and explore interests. And I think there's way too little of that. There's like one or the other. There's like, go to school and figure it out for yourself, which is where I was. And then there's like, become a doctor, lawyer, engineer. And neither of those are good. Kids need gentle nudges, but they don't need to be yanked in one direction or totally left adrift.
And I think that one of the worst questions you could ask kids is what do you want to be when you grow up? Because in any way, presupposes that what they're being right now is not good enough, as opposed to just said like exploring, investigating, like what is it that piques your interest, what is it you naturally move towards, what is it that you enjoy doing.
Well, also, what options are there? When you're a kid, it's like your parents do something. So if your parents are, one's a lawyer and the other one's an auto worker, or one's a teacher and the other's an auto worker, you're like, teacher, auto worker. Let's see, I'm in school now. So teacher's another one. There's army, because you know about the army. There's doctor, nurse, policeman, fireman. When you're in high school, there are like a few more choices because you know what your friends' parents do, McDonald's. But that's it. Yeah. Yeah. And you've been like a consumer. So you're like, I want to, cause there were people in middle school that were like, I want to work at the roller skating rink, cause I like roller skating. And I'm just like, that's what is going, but I can't really judge those people because I was like, I don't know. Right. I was like, oh, working for the phone company would be interesting. Like, okay. Cause I like taking apart phones. I mean, that was not the, but looking at it now, I'm like, oh my God, when you're an adult and you're in college, you really don't know. You're doctor, lawyer, policeman, fireman, army. Like, your options are 10% wider than that. You really don't even know what jobs there are. I was like, diplomat, because that sounds interesting, even though I'm not sure what they do. Like, all you know are what you see in movies and TV. Nobody really knows that biotech engineers exist. Nobody's like, hey, who designs the projectors in the theater? Like, that might be really cool. Yeah. I should study science and light and physics and engineer. Like, you just don't have those on your smorgasbord of options. So that's the kind of stuff we need to be exploring with kids. That's why things like Career Day, which sounds stupid, are massively important, because kids go, oh, you mean there's a person that makes up how cameras work and that science is improving? That's cool. I love photography, but I'm more interested in how the thing works. I got in trouble for taking my dad's camera apart. Maybe I should look into that.
Yeah, I love that. There's a whole another much deeper conversation we could have about the schooling system as well, but we'll definitely run out of time, which we're close to doing now. I've got one other question, a few more questions, but one I really want to ask here from Darius. Hey, Darius, how you doing, dude? If you had to start at zero list today and start a podcast and wanted to build a show as effectively as possible of the right tribe, how would you do it?
I mean, to build a big show, it's always just money. It's just going on other shows and then buying ads. Like, that's the straight up truth. Like, anybody who's like, oh, just vision it, whatever. Like, that's just not the case. But what you can do is stick to really good content, interview people you're interested in. A lot of people, when they try to build shows, they're like, I need to get Gary Vaynerchuk on. And then I got to have Tony Robbins on. I got to have Tim Ferriss on. You don't need that. Nobody's like searching for that person, finds your show and is like, this is amazing. It's very rare. I rarely, when I ask people how they found my show, so rarely are they like, I was looking for Kobe Bryant interviews and I found yours. Like, that happens occasionally, but it's like very, very, very rare. It's word of mouth that spreads shows. And people don't go, this guy interviewed Kobe Bryant. That happens occasionally, but it's more like, this person gets so many guests you've never even heard of, and they're really good. It's done well. Yeah. That's what spreads it around, because otherwise you're a commodity. Like, podcasting, when I started, it was like, hey, there's this thing you can download and this guy is like talking to people. It's kind of like a news show, but there's no commercials. Then it was unique. Now nobody goes, hey, Jordan has a podcast, you should get it. People are like, and what? There's literally like a million podcasts or more now. So you have to do it well. You have to do it better than other people. You can't just be like, I'm the guy that interviews people. Yeah, you and 300,000 other people. Not unique, not interesting. What is it that you do that's not a total commodity? That's what you have to pick and double down on, get good at, hone your skills. If you're like the best person to interview people who own pet shops because you yourself own pet shops and you helped your friend open a pet shop and you like interviewing pet shop owners, that's a good niche. Like, double down on that. Don't sit there and be like, oh, I've got to have like a famous person come on. So I interviewed Larry Bird or some like retired basketball player that was like popular in the 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever. Like, that's not really going to get you this big win. And you can't stack those even if you did. If your uncle is Tom Cruise, go ahead and get the interview, but it's not, people aren't going to find it and go, oh, I want to hear everything this guy's done. If you have no skill, they're going to go, why did Tom Cruise do that crappy ass show? So you can't really rely on that. You just have to do things that you're good at, create really good stuff. And then over time, people will share it because it's worth sharing. The only other option other than that is spend literally like hundreds of thousands of dollars on advertising and then hope certain amount of people stick. I am doing both of these things, doing what I think are really good, top-notch interviews with my team, having them polished, done really well. And then I spend a ton of money making sure people know about the show. That's how it's grown. You don't have to spend the money, but what you do have to do is do good work, because crappy work just doesn't stick. There's too much stuff out there. Looking at like popular TV interviewers and stuff in the 80s and 90s, I go, oh, I better study so-and-so. I don't want to mention any names, but I'll be like, I got to study this person. They were like a legendary interviewer in the 80s. And I'm watching and listening and I'm like, this is not that good. And I'm like, how are they popular? Oh, here's what happened. They were on the radio. They got a morning show gig by some luck and some hard work. They stuck with that. They were good enough. Then they got picked up by CNN because they had an audience and they were good at that. Now they're famous. Well, okay, how many big interviewers were there back then? Oh, five, because there were four major networks and they had like a couple on each one. There were eight maybe interviewers and he was one of them. Okay, now there's a million. Now how do you stick out? Well, it's not showing up. Like just showing up was enough back then. Like showing up and not screwing it up. The bar is much higher now.
Yeah, such wise advice. Great question, Darius. And apologies to everyone else who's put through questions this morning that we haven't got a chance to answer.
Oh, man.
I've got one question for you before we go. So, Jordan, if you were to have a conversation with the 10-year-old version of you, knowing what you know now, having lived the last 40 years of your life, what advice would you give him?
I would say don't worry so much about what you're going to do when you grow up, because I spent literally like decades being like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. What am I going to do? I don't like to do anything. Yeah. And then even in college, I was like, I'd talk to my friends and they go, oh yeah, I'm going to be a lawyer. My dad's a lawyer. And I'd be like, oh, okay. My college roommates are like, we're going to be doctors. We're going to be investment bankers. And I was like, crap. I'm the only person who doesn't know what they want to do. Entrepreneur was not a like business owner. We didn't even use the word entrepreneur. That's like new. It wasn't like open your own business. The only people I know that opened their own business, they were like landscapers and they owned restaurants. I was like, well, I'm not going to do that. That's what business owners do. It never occurred to me that you could like create something, do something. There was no such thing as an independent journalist, writer. There was no interviewer. Like you couldn't do any of this stuff. So I'd be like, hey, technology is going to change. And pretty soon you're not going to have to like start in the mailroom and work your way up in a newspaper office to be a journalist. You're not going to make $4 an hour doing it. Like, I just would have chilled and relaxed a little bit. And also I probably would have skipped college because it's 4 years of undergrad, 3 years of law school, $200,000 in 7 years. I probably would have just like traveled more and worked on some different stuff. You know, I don't necessarily regret it, but I don't think it was the best use of that time and money. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Love that. Jordan, mate, appreciate you, brother. Appreciate your time today. How can the viewers and listeners today connect with you more?
Yeah, I'm much more calm and rational and palatable and less obnoxious on the Jordan Harbinger Show podcast. People can look for the Jordan Harbinger Show. I let my guests talk like you did today, so that was great. And I'm at Jordan Harbinger on Twitter and Instagram. And if people had questions that they like didn't get in, go ahead and tweet at me. I'm pretty good at getting back to people. It's not super fast, like it might take me a week, but shoot me a question there. Happy to get back to people on there. But yeah, check out the Jordan Harbinger Show. And I also teach people how to make and create relationships. It's a free course. There's no upsells. You don't have to like put in your credit card. JordanHarbinger.com/course is where that is. That's where I teach people like outreach, maintenance, you know, really, really quick stuff. It's called 6-minute networking because it's not like a big deal. It's just really tiny little habits every day that work.
Awesome. Jordan, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show this morning. Thank you to each and every one of our listeners and viewers for your continued support and love. Make sure you hit the like button, subscribe, and look forward to seeing you on the next one. Jordan, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Game Changers podcast. There's a couple of things I'd love you to do to help us and help yourself to spread the message further. Make sure that you like the Game Changers on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn. Please subscribe by clicking the link below to ensure that you keep up to date with the weekly episodes we share here at the Game Changers podcast with amazing entrepreneurs and business owners around the world. And of course, like if you're in a position where you may be overwhelmed with business or looking for a way to grow faster, more effectively, and you realize that the key to success is being surrounded by amazing people who have been there and done that before, I'd like to invite you to apply to have a game plan session one-on-one with one of my team here at the Game Changers. There's no cost if you get through. All that we ask is that you are doing a minimum of $250,000 per year to really be able to utilize the strategies and tactics and the mindset shifts that we share with you, that you're coachable, that you're a decent person, and you're willing to take on board some advice. If not, that's totally cool. But I know for me, I wouldn't be where I am right now without the support of so many mentors and coaches and resources along the way. And I'd like to pay that forwards and give back to you the opportunity to work with us one-on-one for free to put together a customized game plan
And the reason we're doing this is a couple of things. Number one is that sometimes it's just the smallest thing that can make the biggest difference. And I think that entrepreneurs and business owners have the opportunity to change the world. And if we can maybe help you to make the smallest shift to change your life and your world, you're changing ours in return. The second thing is that we are always looking for amazing clients to work with and to welcome into and invite into the Game Changers community. And so if at the end of the call, you do feel that there's a huge amount of value there, that we feel that there's a great values fit there, we can have a conversation about working together. But this game plan call, there's absolutely no obligations to work with whatsoever. Allow us to help you with the years and years and years of knowledge that we have in growing and scaling great companies. And I think that business owners are the future of the world. If there's a way that we can help you to create a better business, more profit, more fulfillment, more fun, I would love the opportunity to do that now. So click the link below, book your game plan session, make sure you follow us on social and start today with the latest episodes of the Game Changers podcast. My name's Barry William Magnetti. Thank you so much for your support and look forward to seeing you next one. Bye for now.